This is Greg Johnson, the CEO of conversation intelligence company Invoca. One thing I know is how to use technology to discover new ways to improve the sales conversations that drive revenue for your company. And if you want to learn how to transform your sales teams from just taking orders to breaking their quota, how to significantly increase your revenue, and how to create scalable sales systems, you should be listening to the Authentic Persuasion Show with my good friend Jason Cutter.
Welcome to the Authentic Persuasion Show, a place where business and thought leaders come to weigh in on important sales-related topics that you can use in your sales career and life. I'm your host, Jason Cutter. My mission is to get your help in changing sales from something prospects fear to an act of service they actually seek out and appreciate. Whether you're in sales, leading sales teams, or own a business, I hope this helps you improve your selling effectiveness and you can go out into the world as an authentic persuader. On the Authentic Persuasion Show with me today is Greg Johnson. Greg is the CEO of Invoca, the leader in conversational intelligence for revenue-focused teams. He is a seasoned digital marketer and SaaS leader with 20 years of extensive experience bringing products to market in emerging categories and working with the world's best enterprise brands. And this is not just something to say as a nice fancy intro. Like, it's really true if you look at what Greg has done in the past, because prior to joining Invoca and leading it to where it is now, he led product management teams at Salesforce for their marketing cloud. Also, many things he's done in the past prior to that. But his work at Salesforce with marketing cloud was dealing with integrating $1 billion of mergers and acquisition investments into the Salesforce product portfolio. And I remember that time period with Salesforce where it was just absorbing and collecting and then growing. And for him to be a part of that is pretty amazing. So I'm super excited, as I always am, to have a conversation with Greg. Greg, welcome to the Authentic Persuasion Show.
Thank you, Jason. Appreciate it. I was trying not to blush or say, aw, shucks, as you did that introduction.
If it helps, the same thing happens to me whenever I'm a guest on somebody else's show, even if they read what I gave them. But if they add to it, I was like, wow. It sounds weird hearing it. I don't know. I think we're probably similar. I don't need to brag about myself or tell that part. Like, I just want to get into the conversation. So
yeah,
I was totally relate.
I was about to call my wife in and say, hey, listen to this guy.
Listen to this. I do good stuff. Believe me. And I'm really excited about this because if anyone's not familiar with it, Invoca is a conversational intelligence platform, which I'll let you touch on real quick, which will guide kind of where we're going in the conversation. But generally, your side has been focused on the marketing, right? Like at Salesforce, yeah, you were working on marketing cloud and all that. And then it's this marketing piece, which is then diving into conversational behavioral intelligence and all of that, which is then evolving into sales, which should be fun. So for people who aren't familiar with it, what does Invoca do? Like, what's the biggest value to businesses, to users?
Yeah. So at Invoca, our mission is really to help revenue teams that predominantly large B2C companies drive more effective customer acquisition and deliver a better buying experience for their customers. So we tend to work with companies in relatively complex industries or expensive industries where products aren't just simple things that you buy on Amazon and for 15 or 20 bucks and keep if you like and send back if you don't. Things like healthcare, insurance, mortgage and lending, cable and communications, products that are relatively complex where people oftentimes want some buying assistance, want to talk to somebody to help make sure they've got the right product or service. And so we work with customers like Dish Networks and telecommunications, university hospitals and healthcare, and folks like that. And really our mission is to help the revenue teams, the sales and marketing teams at those companies deliver the best combination of digital experience and human touch and advice. And so really figure out what's the best tool for the job to help that consumer who's thinking about buying a product or service get the information they need, get the confidence they need to make the right buying decision about the right product and become lifelong customers, and really helping you deploy your digital and human assist toolkit to do that. And so, traditionally we've done a lot of work in marketing. Over the past few years, we've done a lot of work in understanding human to human conversation and recently launched new products around sales, e-commerce, and customer experience that take us closer and closer to the world of the contact center and inside sales and agents and things they do.
So, with what you provide as your service, right, as your platform, the goal is to get somebody to make that transition from a digital experience into a customer, or digital experience into a phone call. Is that right? Or is it potentially all digital?
Either way, I mean, I tend to think of it as we want to help companies deliver the right experience that their consumers want. And so sometimes that may be completing the entire transaction end to end through digital. And when you're trying to do that, oftentimes when the kinks appear in digital and something doesn't quite work. So like, I'll give you an example. A lot of times in the industries that we serve, whether it's telecommunications or mortgage and lending, part of the buying process is getting a credit check done. And there are different levels of comfort in providing things like a social security number over the internet. And so sometimes people will type that right in. Sometimes they'll say, hey, I'm not comfortable giving you my credit card number, my social security number of the internet. Let me call in and talk to a human agent. And so we try to help people identify, first track that journey of what did you do online, and then what led to the conversation that happens. And based on the outcome of that conversation, what's the right next step back in the digital universe? For example, if you didn't buy, but you seemed pretty interested in the product, well, then we should re-engage with you over Google or Facebook or email or those sort of things. But also help to identify to those commerce teams, when people leave the digital experience and they reach out for assistance, is that something that's just broken in your digital flow that you can improve? Or is that a real human value-added experience where that inside selling person has the expertise, can address questions, can do things that digital just can't do in order to help a consumer feel confident they're making the right buying decision? Because again, most of these products that are being sold are relatively expensive or complex. I like to think about, I've gotten mortgages a couple times in my life. I'm a finance guy. I like Excel. I've got an MBA. You'd think I've got it all down. But like when I start looking at different mortgage products, I end up talking to somebody and asking, you know, how do I think about product A versus product B? Where are the rates moving in the market right now? Tapping into that expertise is a real value add for which mortgage bank I'm going to go to. And so our goal is to help you deliver a seamless experience, regardless of what path any individual consumer wants to go down between digital buying and buying from the contact center.
Yeah, and I think that's valuable and important too, which is you're looking at a mortgage, you want to get a mortgage, you have questions, theoretically in a group, in a category of people who could just do it on your own and should know the answers, right? Finance, MBA, like I get it. I used to do mortgages. That was my first sales job, if you will. The people who like understood it and then the people who just didn't. And I know there's companies out there that are trying to do that like completely online and thinking that people just want to go completely digital, but there's some blend. With what you've seen at your time, let's just say just at Invoca, is there any shifts you've seen in anything in kind of the, I don't want to say contact center space, but like the customer journey engagement, like anything that's changed, either more digital, less digital?
Jason, just dependent. Are you asking me if anything's changed in 2020? Is that
no? I'm saying in general. Like I have some guesses. Kidding. Talk about 2020. That's just a hot mess.
I'm kidding. No, I mean, I definitely think there's an undeniable shift towards doing things more digitally, right? Like whether you're in B2C or in B2B, it's inevitable that consumers and buyers are doing more research online. They're coming more prepared with questions and information to make the buying decision. And so what I think that results in is it's raised the bar in terms of what consumers expect out of interaction with one of your agents, one of your sales representatives, one of your experts, right? Like it used to be that I would call and speak to a human being because I had no other option. Today, I call in and speak to a human being because I think that's the next best step for me. So one of my favorite examples here is Quicken Loans and Rocket Mortgage. And if you remember, Rocket Mortgage launched the new, you can get a mortgage entirely online offering at the Super Bowl 4 or 5 years ago. But if you look through the Rocket Mortgage process, they offer you the option to call and speak to a mortgage advisor or to reach out via chat throughout the process. And I think we actually did some consumer research over the past few months showing that people, even if they're doing something digitally, it gives them comfort and confidence to know that if they want help and assistance, that there's an opportunity for them to get that via the contact center, whether it's something like chat or a conversation. And so I think users and consumers are much more equipped. They're much more informed thanks to the rides. I think making more things available via digital self-service is great. And then that lets you focus your human-to-human interactions on things that are really, truly value-added. So I'm not calling a mortgage broker to understand what the rate is or what my down payment is and my monthly payment is going to be. I can do that online. I'm calling to get emotional reassurance that I'm making the best financial decision for my family when I refinance my house or when I buy a new house and get a mortgage. And so I think delivering a great experience that leverages the boast of digital self-service and that value-added human connection, I think is a trend that we see in the market. Is the really compelling brands, they do a combination of those two things incredibly well.
It's interesting because my biased experiences in the world is what you said about that Rocket Mortgage Quicken Loan example, which is there was this push to go all digital, all online, chat bots, forms, self-service mode years and years ago. And then I feel like there's actually kind of been a kick to a blend and or the other way, which is people realizing there's certain things I just don't want to do online. I want some adult supervision. I have questions and I need answers. And so it's interesting to hear what you're saying fitting my experience as well, which is that blend, because there are still people, and it's not even generational. Like there's some stuff I only want to do online and I only want to chat. And then there's certain other, let's say, first time home buyers, they could be millennials. They're new at this process. They want to talk to somebody, right? Yeah. Like really the ultimate thing is you got to meet people where they are and then help them go through the journey.
I completely agree. And I also think with all the focus on customer experience the past few years, what we see is that in some ways, products themselves are being commoditized and experience is becoming a real differentiator. And one of the things that we don't talk a lot about is how do you make it easy for people to buy? We think about that in the transactional nature of things, but we don't think about that in the emotional nature of things. Now, I'll tell you a funny story, Jason, you can share whether you relate. I go on Amazon now. Amazon is so amazing because they removed all the friction from buying things. And so, but I still, because of my habit, and I'll go on to buy something that'll cost like $20. And I find myself reading review after review after review after review because I want to feel good about what I'm buying. I want to feel that if I'm going to go buy a $20 thing, I bought the best $20 thing on the market. And there are sometimes I'll catch myself, I'm like, I've spent 15 minutes reading reviews for a $20 product. That if I don't like, I can drop by the UPS store and I don't even have to put in a box to return.
Yeah.
So the beauty is that for those low value transactional goods, Amazon has just removed all this friction. And I ask myself, like, why am I spending all this time reading these reviews? And then you think about making a more complicated purchase. So I'll sneak into 2020 land. When like April or May, when it became clear, I live in Northern California, when it became clear that we weren't going to be going anywhere on vacation, we're going to be spending a lot more time at home. We get a lot of sun in our backyard. And so my wife and I are like, we need to get a nice umbrella so that we have some shade when we want to go sit downstairs. I had this dream that I was going to go block out like 90 minutes a day to go sit down in my outer patio and like think deep thoughts and do work outside. Of course, that didn't happen. And so I went to go get a cantilever umbrella. And these things range from like $500 to, I was up in Napa with my wife a few weeks ago and we saw this model that I'd seen reaching online. It's like $10,000 for an umbrella. And I started reading about it. I'm like, I have no idea what I'm buying. And so I picked up the phone and I called one of the manufacturers and I had a great 10-minute conversation with somebody who taught me about the pros and cons of how to think about this model and what did I need? Because one of the things I worried about is wind. We get a lot of afternoon wind in our backyard. So I was asking about wind ratings and I got in 10 minutes out of a conversation with an expert, what would have taken me 3 hours to do researching online. And we ended up getting an umbrella and getting one of these big things and sending it back would have cost me like $50 or $100. And so there are some buying decisions that are kind of one-way streets. And, you know, like if you think about, I know nobody's going anywhere these days, but if you think about travel and hospitality, my wife and I, we had our 15-year wedding anniversary last year. We went to New York for 4 or 5 days. I'm never going to get another 15-year wedding anniversary trip. I only get one. If it goes bad, I can't take it back. And so being able to talk to somebody about those types of things when you're going on, like you think about like a silver anniversary or gold anniversary cruise or other things like that, that aren't things you can buy for $20 from Amazon. And if you don't like them, you can just send them back. Like there's a lot invested in those decisions. And I think in a way, you know, brands have been really smart because they pushed a lot of that work of getting to the right comfort level to make a buying decision. They've enabled us to do that work ourselves by reading reviews and all these things. But sometimes a review is just not going to get you there, right? Like when you're looking at one of these big decisions about like a mortgage or buying a house or going on a cruise or something like that, or healthcare, reading reviews ain't going to get it done. And even I find now, like I'm reading reviews and I shouldn't be reading reviews. And so I ask myself, like, Craig, your time is more valuable. Go spend some time with your kids. Stop reading reviews on Amazon. Just buy the thing for $20, $30. And if you don't like it, send it back. Yeah. Yeah.
Or like some people do, and I do that thing with the review too. Sometimes I'll just buy multiple versions of it and then return the ones that I don't want. Like that's what my mom used to do when I was growing up, and she would go to Nordstrom. And Nordstrom has a very liberal return policy.
Yeah.
And so she would walk out with like 8-9 pairs of shoes and then a month later take back 6 of them, which is not good for their commission. But it's interesting as you're talking about this, because I'm thinking psychologically and behavior. One thing, and I say this a lot, but I'm going to say it again because your story is so perfect, is that most buyers in the world right now have at their fingertips, within arm reach, 24 hours a day, all the world's information, right? They don't need salespeople for information. They don't need them for data, for knowledge. Like all that's available. What they need or want from a salesperson, from a professional, is they want wisdom. They want the application of that data for their situation. Your Brelin story, it might seem silly to some people, but literally that's the perfect application of that thesis, which is you have the data, you have the stats. You could look it up and see what the wind ratings are, but which one is going to be the right one and why for Greg Johnson, right? And Greg Johnson's backyard in Greg Johnson's part of Northern California. And so that wisdom is what they want. And that's where I see a lot of salespeople go wrong, is they're still stuck in the olden days where there was no internet and there was no info and the salesperson was the keeper of the info and that's their value, like old school car sales. And like that shift is so important to like know that the role is the wisdom.
Yeah, no, that's totally true. It's funny that you mention cars. We just had our annual customer event virtually a few weeks ago called Invoca Summit. And one of our speakers was the Senior Vice President of Marketing and E-Commerce from AutoNation. And when it comes to automotive, like I'm not a car person. I've had, I think, 4 cars in my life. So I'm not a car enthusiast. So I haven't bought many cars. But it was interesting listening to him talk about car buyers, because he said, there's just this dramatic difference. There are people who will literally walk into a dealership on a Saturday and they're leaving with the car. And there are other people who've read Car and Driver and know exactly what they want, and they want to configure the car down to the very last detail, and they want to make the best decision between like option A versus option B, not in terms of the finishes, but performance. And those are just two completely different buyers.
Yeah.
And the buying experience for those two people is going to be completely different. And the role that somebody at a dealership is going to play with them is going to be very different. And if you approach those people and those two different buyers in the exact same way, as if their buying process was going to work in the exact same way, you're not going to be very successful. So I totally agree. Like as a seller, you have to think about how you synthesize the information, how you really understand where your buyer's coming from and how you match those patterns. And I think, again, to kind of do a quick 2021, one of the things that I think has been interesting this year that we've seen across a lot of customers in our business has been things that we all took for granted before, we can no longer take for granted. So we would take for granted, this is what a customer is looking for, or this is what they expect. And it's a little bit old now, but my favorite joke here was, if you were marketing or selling hand sanitizer back in January and February, what you would have said to your buyer is like, hand sanitizer, top quality, doesn't burn your skin, blah, 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 blah. If you were marketing and selling hand sanitizer in March, you would say hand sanitizer, A, it's available. B, we deliver it to your home. Like that's all that matters.
That's it.
It's it. Like what's the product made from? I joked around. We got this hand sanitizer. My wife got like a case of it in March and it said non-alcoholic. And every time I put it on my hands, I'm like, this smells like tequila. It smells like tequila. It's like, it makes me think of Mexico. It makes me think of being out by the beach. It makes me think of having a margarita. But all they needed to advertise and sell in March was like, it's hand sanitizer and it's available and we can send it to your house. And so things have changed so much. We have another customer, again, kind of speaking in my heart, Barbecue Guys, who is an e-commerce company that sells grills and all sorts of outdoor patio furniture, umbrellas, things like that. And for them, so many customers who have manufactured goods have had issues with the supply chain because of COVID, because of factories being shut down. And so now the salespeople, part of their job is when you call in and you say, hey, I'm looking to buy grill from brand XYZ and they don't have that in stock. They've got to understand, what is it about that grill that is important to you as a buyer? What other products do I have that meet that need? And how can I match what's available in inventory to the need that you have? And if you go back a year ago, I'm sure everybody would think like, I've got infinite inventory. I've got every make, every model, every iteration, whatever you need, I have. Whereas because of the business disruptions from COVID, now there's an art and a craftsmanship to being a seller that's understanding the consumer's needs and wants and desires and figuring out how to best match that. And so, yeah, it's definitely, it's an interesting world that we live in today.
And that speaks to something I've been talking about for a few years now, which was when talking to certain companies, I would get a resistance, which was, and their response to consulting or training would be, I know our team could use it. I don't want to upset them. What isn't broke, don't fix it. They're making enough money. I know they could be doing better, but it's fine, right? We're doing okay. And my thought is, yeah, you're doing okay in a good economy, in a positive economy, when things are going great, when it just show up and do a half decent job and you'll be successful enough. And I was like, but that economy can't sustain. And that was without a pandemic coming. That was just like economies come and go, right? They go up and they go down. And then that's what we're seeing. We're seeing that reaction a lot of companies I've seen, which is they weren't really good at sales. They weren't really good at selling and customer service and the experience. And then now it's like, then they had to either shift or disappear.
Oh yeah. And then you add everything that's happened over the past 9 months on top of that. There's some really interesting research and statistics that came out from McKinsey in August, I think, talking about the fact that 75% of all consumers since the beginning of COVID-19 have tried a new brand, bought through a new channel, so like e-commerce as opposed to something else, or purchased something from a new location. So literally 3/4 of consumers have tried something new in the past 6 to 9 months. And I think a lot of folks get worried about that. And they say, hey, like that means my most loyal consumers are at risk. But here's the other thing, like you've now got more things freeing loose in the market than ever before. Yeah. I mean, the example I think of is like your grocery store. Your grocery store is probably the place where you have the most shopping loyalty of like almost any of the categories you buy from, because you've traditionally been attached to the geography of it, right? Like you've got two choices within a few miles of your house. You go there again and again and again. You're a loyal customer for decades and decades and decades. And obviously we've seen, you know, like food delivery and grocery delivery behavior just explode in the last 6 or 9 months. And so if you can adjust and you can be nimble and you can really adapt to this reality, both in how your marketing and your value proposition is and how you're selling and delivering things and value to that consumer, to the whole customer experience of it all, there's tremendous upside. There's also downside, but I think people sometimes they get scared and they think only about the downside without thinking about the upside. We're also seeing a lot more emphasis on that human touch, that human connection. It was interesting, Jason, our event, I heard both sales and marketing professionals use a word again and again and again this fall that I have never heard them use in the past, which is the word empathy. When have you ever heard a sales and marketing professional before 2020 talk about the concept of empathy? Never.
Never.
And I think everybody.
Never enough.
Yeah, never enough. Jason, I forgot. You talk about empathy in your training all the time.
I talk about it. And you know what? That's what's interesting too, is in the beginning of all this, let's say March, April, living a lot on LinkedIn, chatting with a lot of people, seeing a lot of conversations, it was interesting to see how many people out there were saying, hey, this is a crisis. Don't worry about closing deals. Have empathy, build relationships, have conversations with people, show empathy and concern. And that's the best tactic. And I'm literally screaming going, that's always been the best tactic.
I've been saying that for years and years.
It's not new.
Yeah.
Wait, it's not new to care about people and then serve them by helping them buy if it's the right fit. But you should have always been doing it. Were you doing? That's what worries me.
Yeah, no, that is definitely true. I like to be sort of facetious on the empathy joke, but especially in the, even more so in the world of marketing, I would say in the world of sales, we've talked about personalizing things. We've talked about having a holistic view of your customer and what they're trying to do. But I feel like that was always very data, logic, kind of mechanically driven, as opposed to emotionally driven. One of the things that 2020 has hopefully taught us all is people buy from people. And the idea that the consumer is not just an abstract vector of buying preferences with a consideration set. They're human beings that if you can connect with them at that more emotional level, you can do some things that are really powerful and help differentiate your brand. And so, I think unfortunately it's taken a pandemic to remind us of that and to prove Jason Cutter right. But you're right for one reason or another.
I appreciate it. Luckily, that's recorded, so that's awesome. Yeah, and I think one of the challenges, both sales and marketing and anything, is that it's hard to track empathy as a KPI, which is what most businesses, I'm going to say, devolve to, which is leadership via KPIs. And then they're trying to measure everything. Okay, the personalization. Is our empathetic personalization of mass emails getting us a better response rate? Then that's a good strategy or not.
Yeah.
Versus like that blend. And it's tough when you have something, you can't have a KPI to empathy because you can't measure, okay, well, you cared and then they bought or they will buy in a year relative to an empathy scale.
So I mostly,
or can you?
Well, no, the technologist in me gets excited. So
yes,
I don't think you can have the perfect KPI for empathy, but I think in the world of selling and conversations, we've gone from conversations being a complete black hole that you can't measure, you can't analyze, that we're very binary in terms of outcomes. Like, did something good happen or did something bad happen? And the advancements of technology over the past few years have helped us break those things down and have attributes about conversations and have data about conversations and be able to use some KPIs about conversations that may not give you the perfect golden answer, but helps get you to a lot more clarity around what's going well and what's not. I think one of the things that I see in the marketing part of our business, in a way, is that marketers would instinctually try to drive people to convert digitally, not because they thought it was the best thing to do, but simply because they could measure it. And if they drove people to buy from a conversation, they couldn't measure it. They didn't get credit for it. And when the budgeting season came around at the end of the year and the CFO said, "How many sales have you driven for me?" they could only measure their e-commerce digitally driven sales. And so they tended to focus on that. Well, now we've sort of leveled the playing field where we help marketers understand what revenue am I driving via conversations, as well as what revenue am I driving via digital, so I can make data-driven decisions about what's the best way to serve my customer. And then on the sales side as well, we're using technology to help really bring insights and help managers understand, where is my team doing a good job? Where are they having the right conversations? Are they demonstrating the right approach versus where are they not? And now I can be a little bit more scientific about how I engage with my team, how I help my team, how I coach my team to help make them better. And I think that's been part of the challenge in the past, is that was all art and no science. And I'm not going to go so far as to say is conversational intelligence is all science and no art these days. But on that range, I think it's moved from art to more science, which coincidentally really helps in a COVID world, where a lot of these teams are now working from home, where they used to be co-located, where you used to be a manager, you used to be able to do management by walking around. You could hear what was going on. You could compare best practices. And it's a lot harder to do that when you've got 10 people in 10 different locations these days. So I tend to think of things on a sort of a spectrum of extremes. And selling has gone from being lots of art with no science to a lot more science. And I think part of being able to understand that science is that lets you then focus on the artistry of it a little bit more, because you've got some structure and some data around some of the basics.
Which I couldn't agree more, because in my experience, the more you can put in systems, processes, the analytics, like what you're talking about, Invoca does, the conversational intelligence and being able to use AI and detect things like empathy and what's said and what's not, the more you can put those tools in place, like some people don't like it, but it more actually frees you up from all the stuff you have to think about or do and allows you to then focus on the conversation. A lot of people in sales, like, I don't want a script. I don't want a process. I don't want accountability. I don't want a CRM. I just let me do what I do best. But it's tough, because to be a sales professional, you have to do lots of things outside of just the conversation. So the more those things are handled with technology, the goal is just you do what you do best, which is converse with that person and move it forward.
Completely. I mean, I think about, you know, like growing up playing basketball, you've got to learn to dribble with your right hand, and then you learn to dribble with your left hand, and then you learn to sort of cross over and do both, and you learn to dribble between your legs. And then the ultimate expression of artistry, like when you watch LeBron James, you're not sort of like, does he have the mechanics of dribbling with his right hand and his left hand down? No, like, because he's got those fundamentals down, now the art really comes out. It was interesting. I thought about you earlier today. I was on LinkedIn. There's a study that came out from Bain & Company. They asked sales reps, how many of you would pay a dollar to spend an hour with your manager? Essentially, how valuable is your manager's time? Jason, take a guess. What percentage of sales reps surveyed by Bain & Company would spend a dollar to get an hour more of their manager's time?
I'm going to say 18.2%.
46%. I took that article, I linked to it, I put it in our leadership executive team Slack channel, and I said, our head of sales is an awesome guy. I love working with him, named Ben Sullivan. And I said, who wants to go have a lunch with Ben for an hour to talk shop for $1? I was amazed. And I think that sort of speaks to, can you as a manager effectively help your team get better? Can you help them master the fundamentals so that you can focus on the artistry? And I was just flabbergasted because I'm going to talk about myself for a minute, which I don't really like doing, but like, I always say to my team, like, my job is to help you. If we as a company do the right thing and we hire the right people, the people that we hire are going to want to go be their best. I'm not going to need to encourage you to try to be better. I'm going to need to help you get better. And I'm going to need to tell you when to relax and stop pushing yourself too hard. But like, if you get the right management employee relationship, it's all about helping employees be better and achieve their best. Like, I'd like to think of my job at our company is like effectively like a gymnastics coach or a basketball coach. Like, my job is to help everybody be better and to hold the standard and help people understand how they can be better. But I was just flabbergasted that over half of sales reps were essentially saying, I don't want any more of my manager's time. That tells me there is a very fundamental problem and how managers are trying, but not being successful in helping make their teams better when it comes to the art of selling.
And that's a topic for a completely another episode, or this will be a 2-hour long. I think this might actually already probably for way long anyway, which is fine with me. I think there's many reasons for that. There's many challenges. And I think one of the things, and you said it and it was really quick, but when you have that servant leadership mode, right, where as a leader, you feel like your job is to serve and support others, not for them to support and serve you, then it shifts. And then I think where a lot of people in management roles or leadership titles are missing the mark with their teams is they're managing versus coaching. I mean, you said you see your role as a coach. A lot of sales managers feel like it's the carrot or the stick and they're cracking whips and they're the all-knowing person versus a coach, which is, you know, drawing things out and holding the framework and holding people accountable, right? And a high standard. But still, it's like once the game is going, I can't do the game for you. So you're the one out there on the court playing. I need to coach you to the victory. And too many sales managers end up in that role because they were good at sales. They got promoted because there was a hole in the org chart. Now they're a sales manager. Nobody gave them any kind of training. And they're just leading how they think, which is, I'm good at sales, so move over. I'll just sell for you. And no one wants an hour of that time.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And I think the other thing too, I always joke around, I come from a product management background. Actually, I had about a year of carrying a bag, which was a fun experience for me and its own hour in of itself. But I think a lot about the opposite extreme, which is like people that I work with tend to view me as like a super nice guy and you're not going to be super directive and you aren't going to push people hard. But I often remind people, like, part of your job as a coach is to get your team more ready and more prepared for the next game. And if you're not pushing and prodding and asking questions and helping them get better, you're not helping them get better for the next game. Then that is the definition of your job. And so I think you have to kind of do that as well. Is I think when people come from a very high performance sales background, they tend to push, and they tend to want to get in there and like do the deal themselves. And that's sort of one end of the extreme of the problems. I think the other extreme is like, hey, you know, my job's not to get in my team's way, but you have to hold that standard. You have to kind of drive that accountability. And that's where I was in a completely different topic. I was in a product review call this morning, and we were talking about something that was very granular. And that, frankly, I like to use this phrase a lot, hashtag, this is not a CEO decision. Like, I think as a CEO, there are really 5 decisions that I need to make every year. I'll give you my personal philosophy on this in just a second. There are 5 decisions I need to make every year, and that's all I should do. But the reason I brought this up, and I said this explicitly to the team, I said, I'm not bringing this up because this is my decision. It's not. I'm bringing it up because I want you to understand how I think about it. And it's kind of a teaching moment of like, the team is going to go down a path and looked at something, was like, hey, we think we should do this. And I was like, I'm not sure that's right. And I want you to understand why I think that's not right. And then if you apply your own thinking in that way and you decide it's right, great. That's your decision. It's not my decision. But if I just let you go down that path without holding you to that higher standard, I'm not really doing my job. So yeah, hashtag not a CEO decision. I was a first-time CEO when I came to Invoca. And one of the things that I've learned is, as a CEO, or if you run sales, if you're in a sales meeting, if you're in a meeting and you don't say anything otherwise, everybody in the room assumes you're making the decision. You know, if we come into a meeting with our head of sales and you're saying, hey, we've got a problem with a competitor and they're putting an offer out, should we match it? Should we not? When you're the most senior person in the room, if nothing else happens, everybody in the room is going to think that you're making the decision. And when that happens, everybody's kind of accountability ownership level goes down a little bit.
100%.
And so for me, my tactic of kind of beating that back has been to say in a meeting, this is not a CEO decision, which essentially to me says, you got to be ready. You're going. It's your turn. It's not my turn. I'm here to give you feedback. I'm here as a peer to help you think through the problem, but it's your job to make a decision on this, not mine. And it's one of those things that took me a year or two to learn, that I'd come into these meetings and then we talk for like an hour and there's a silence and everybody look at me and I'm like, sales comp. People be like, oh, should we do X or should we do Y? I'm like, I've never dealt with sales comp in my life. I have no idea. Why are you looking at me? Now, like when it comes to the budget, I've got to make that decision. But like the details of, you know, when do you get this accelerator versus decelerator? It's not my decision. But I realized like I had to label that decision and tell people, I'm not making the call here. You're making the call. Otherwise, they kind of relax. They don't process the information as well. And so I think that's really important for leaders, is to help people draw sort of boundaries of like, what's my job and what's your job? And I'll even say sometimes to people on my team, I'm crossing the line right now. And I'm telling you why I'm crossing the line. Like if you're short on bandwidth and I'm helping you cover for some things, I'll say like, I'm doing some things right now that is not a CEO's job. This is a head of sales job, this head of marketing job, or this is a head of sales strategy job. Because you're in a particular situation, I'll call out the fact that I'm doing that. But like, let's not make a mistake. This isn't my job. Under normal circumstances, I shouldn't be doing this. And so the next time this comes around, you shouldn't come in with the expectation that I'm the one doing this, because this is part of your job. And I'm here to help, but I'm not here to do something that's functionally your job to do. And so I think while being a coach, it's also important to draw boundaries and help people understand if you cross a boundary, you have a reason for doing so. It's all cool, but like, let's label it. Let's be explicit about it so that next time the expectation is there of who does what.
And I have seen that happen many times, bottom up, where again, that sales manager, if we take it at the lowest level of a sales team, is the one that everyone goes to. And then they're just giving advice and telling what to do and going through a pipeline saying, you need to call this person. And then what happens is essentially that salesperson, the level below, is basically is not accountable for anything, doesn't want to be accountable, has abdicated all decision-making and reasoning to the higher level. I remember my first time being a leader in an organization, and the CEO, essentially whenever everyone would come into a meeting with their pipeline, especially on an ops side, like we were dealing with transactions, and it was basically everyone came in with the pipeline, with problems, with issues, and then solutions.
Yeah.
And he would shoot down everyone's solutions, and then he would tell everyone what they were going to do instead. Couple weeks of that, everyone came to the meeting with empty minds, no notes, and a pipeline. And he would just then dictate what to do. And solve the problem. And I remember like a couple weeks of that, he picked up on the trend and he said to me on the side, he's like, why aren't people coming to the solution? I'm like, every time they do, you tell them they're wrong and you tell them what they should do instead. And everyone just knows, like, there's no point in even thinking anymore. And at that point, it's just over, right? You've just lost.
And I think the other thing too, that's really important to be a really good manager and to figure out, especially in sales, like more than any other function in the organization, you have to deliver. Like the pressure to deliver is super high. And so I think it's really important that you think deliberately about, how do I maintain my commitment to the organization to deliver? While how do I also give space to my team to grow and to make mistakes? And I think you have to be really deliberate about that. Like I say to our team a lot, you've got to plan ahead. You've got to say, hey, I'm willing to, like, if you look at a rep and you're not quite sure if what they're doing is the right path, you've got to work backwards from when you need something done to say, this is kind of my buffer time. I'm going to let a rep go try to do something, whether it's transactionally over a couple of days or whether it's a big deal if you're an enterprise. And I'm going to build in enough time where if they fail, I can pick up the pieces with them and still make the transaction work or the volume of transactions work and maintain my commitment to the organization. But if I don't build in that buffer time and they fail in the last week of a quarter or in a transactional business, on a Thursday of a 5-day week, like if you haven't built in the time to recover, that's not the rep's fault. That's your fault as a manager.
Right.
And I think that's important too, as you think about how do I create the right amount of space so that reps have some autonomy. They don't feel like I'm telling them absolutely everything to do and they stop taking accountability. How do I do that? But how also maintain my commitment to the organization to deliver the number that I need in the organization? And that takes careful thought and deliberate planning to meet both of those goals. And I think a lot of time, again, as you said, Jason, when people are really good individual performers, they focus on that commitment to the organization and that's all they're going to focus on. And they're never going to get to the point of stepping away enough to let the reps succeed and fail on their own and grow and be better. And in order to do that, you have to think about how to balance those two things. That thing's really important.
And not go to the extreme of letting people learn or fail or succeed or fail on their own so much that as a manager, you're just so hands off
yeah.
that somebody feels isolated and alone and
Completely.
Live and die. And then that goes back to your Bain study where it was like not even wanting to pay a dollar for an hour of my manager's time because I just feel like they literally don't care. They have no value. They've left me on my own. I
yeah.
really actually don't want to hang out with them. For various reasons. And I think that's fascinating because if I look at, let's say, basketball again, which is one of the sports I enjoy the most, a coach will leave somebody in that should be doing well. If they start slipping and they're missing shots and they're just not doing their thing, they have a buffer in their mind that they will let somebody either pull themselves out of that slump, right? Like a Steph Curry or a LeBron. They're not hitting their shots. They'll give them a little bit of time. Then there's a line in their mind with like, okay, I need to pull them out.
Yeah.
Give them a break, put somebody else in there because the game is more important, right? They win the organization, if you will, but give somebody a chance, but also know that line in the sand, if you will.
Totally agree. That's a really important balance. And I think people don't think explicitly enough about the combination of those two things. You get people either so focused on just delivering to the organization, they forget about long-term building their team, or you get people that are so focused on building their team, they don't think about the importance of maintaining their commitment to the organization. In sales, you got to do both. And yes. So it's like figuring out very explicitly how you do both those things. I didn't realize we were going to get to talk about LeBron today. It's pretty exciting.
I know. This is great. I have a bunch of questions that I want to get to, but one that's been burning in my head that we've been talking for like 20 minutes now is you have tons of experience coming from the marketing side. Also, yourself in sales and everything in life is sales. So not dismissing the sales side of your life and your experience, but the marketing side. And then seeing Invoca's evolution from a marketing-focused intelligence SaaS platform to customer service and then into sales. Where do you think that division is or that transition is from marketing to sales these days?
Whew. Can we go back to talking about 2020?
Something easier to talk about than that. And I know we weren't prepared for this. It came into my mind. And I know it's probably very situational. It just depends on the organization and their sales cycle.
Totally. So I think, let me talk about our go-to-market motion really quickly. And I'll use that example to illustrate. So at Invoca, we tend to be focused on a distinct set of verticals or industries, right? So like it's healthcare, financial services, automotive, telecommunications, things like that. And so in the B2B world of selling and marketing, like we very much embrace this idea of account-based marketing, which is really account-based marketing and selling, to be candid. And so it's been very interesting to me coming to this go-to-market approach from my time at Salesforce. Salesforce was much more of a mass market go-to-market approach. And so you see the roles and responsibilities of sales and marketing change and the dividing line between what marketing does and what sales does change. So while I'd love to come down from Mount Sinai with the tablets for everybody, I think the answer is it really depends on your go-to-market model as to what marketing does and what sales does. So for example, at Salesforce, we would talk about several different engines of pipeline. You had marketing, you had account executives, you had partners, and you had SDRs or BDRs, sort of junior entry-level salespeople. In our go-to-market motion at Invoca, you really have partners, you have AEs to some degree, but then like the marketing machine and the SDR machine at our company are sort of intertwined. Like they really work very, very closely together. And so I think it's hard to give an answer that's holistically applicable. I think the most important thing is your sales team and is your marketing team aligned on what their respective roles and responsibilities are, how you're going to measure success as a company, and how you then break down that success into marketing KPIs and sales KPIs. I'm just a really big believer in alignment. And we had a woman who is a sales leader at Salesforce. And she had this saying that I absolutely loved and truly believe is super important in management, but also sales. She talked about, like, you have to go slow to go fast, yep. Which means if you're thinking about like doing something strategically, you have to make sure that you're aligned on why you're doing something and how you're doing something across the team. And if you spend time investing in that, then you can let the teams go crazy and loose because they understand how success is measured. They understand the relationship of one team to the other. And you can really almost take your hands off the wheel if you've done a good job, because they're going to be oriented to how to get to the goal that you've agreed on. And I think that's the most important thing in this relationship between sales and marketing, is the relative importance or the relative roles and responsibilities may shift between one or the other. The most important things is that leadership and the teams across the two are aligned on the goal, or aligned on what you're trying to achieve, aligned on how you're going to measure it, and then work together to figure out the role of each relative team. And then they can kind of figure it out on themselves. I think the number one challenge is where there is not that top level alignment on strategy, goals, and metrics. That's when you then have to get really down into the weeds of what's team A doing versus team B, because you don't have that senior level, top level alignment.
So good. And for the second conversation we're going to need to have, which will be part two down the road, this one to think about is SDRs and BDRs, marketing or sales? Don't answer it now. We'll talk about it some other time. You got an answer? You have one?
In Invoca, we have them within sales, but I love listening to this conversation. And I think my short answer would be, it depends. It goes back to what your motion is. Like at Salesforce, they sat within sales, and I think that was the right approach. For us, they sit within sales. We've debated about the marketing. I think the strategy has to frame your tactical decisions. And that's why like alignment on the strategy. And there's so many different models now of how you go to market. And so I think it's really hard to say like there's a one size fits all answer to that question. But if somebody's got the tablets, I'd love to hear the answer.
They don't, at least that I know. And I think also really where it's trending to, like a lot of things, is just blending and less of the silo and less of the clear walls and more of the director VP of revenue ops, which is putting it all under one umbrella. And it's not sales and marketing, or generally sales versus marketing. And then it's sales and marketing all together with this whole thing. And everyone is rowing the same direction. And then it's much, much more clear and organized and generally friendly, if you will. So
I'll tell you one more quick caveat note. You have to understand Invoca as a company to understand this question. We have an awesome culture. We're very collaborative. But now one of the things I worry about is like, are we too collaborative? And so my first 2 years at the company, I would say to our head of sales and head of marketing all the time, I'm so grateful that you two don't fight like cats and dogs. You work well together. You're aligned. And after 2 years, I finally said, is there enough tension in this relationship?
Exactly.
Yeah. Are you all calling each other out in a friendly way and challenging each other? And so I think that's part of it too, is you've got to have part of being collaborative. And coming from the marketing world, I think marketing agencies are awesome at this. People at marketing agencies are really good about debating and talking about ideas that are separate from people. And so you can have a vigorous discussion about a creative advertising concept. And it's not me saying, Jason, your idea is horrible, or Jason and Greg, your idea is horrible. It's about the idea. And so I think trying to foster that sense of healthy debate within sales and marketing, I actually said to our head of marketing one time about 2 years ago, I said, we have a meeting where we go over pipeline every week that I sit in. And I was like, I'm going to bring something up and nobody's going to say we're taking this offline for you and the head of sales to go debate. We're going to talk about it
right
in
now.
This meeting, because we have to lead by example and we have to show the respective teams that it's okay if the head of sales and the head of marketing disagree, if they do it in a data-driven, friendly way, and we have to show them that we can work it out to conclusion, we have to model that behavior. And it can't be like, ooh, we disagree whether something is perfectly green or slightly off green. And the only way we can solve that is by going to have a private conversation. Like, that's not healthy behavior. And so I think that's the other thing is, can you as a sales and marketing team get aligned and work well together, but also have a healthy data-driven spirit of debate? And I think that's a skill that you as a team have to build.
And the strong emphasis from what I've seen and talked to lots of other people who are now in CRO roles, as like I have been in the past, is data driven and then transparency of the data. Not in a, like, I'm not even going to get started on politics, but not in a, like, I'm going to spin the data my way and you spin the data your way. But it's like, here's the data. It's real time. It's transparent. Now go. Right. Now let's talk.
Yeah. So I agree.
Yeah. All right. So, for you, in your experience, what does it mean to be authentic?
I have a really hard time with that question because I feel like I can't be anything other than authentic. Like okay. if you were to ask people at our company, everybody would give me feedback and say, like, Greg's a really authentic leader. And it's not because that, it's just the way that I'm wired. I think one of the things I've struggled with, I also really believe in transparency, but it's kind of this idea of when is there information I should share and when is there not? And when am I just sort of mentally unloading my stress on other people versus when am I doing something for their good versus my good? And so I think being authentic for me is not hard. It's very natural. I have a much harder time being inauthentic. But I think the bigger thing for me has really been trying to decide when is it good to share information versus when is it bad to share information. And I think, you know, we're a company, we're about 215 people. Startups are roller coasters. I was talking to an ex-colleague from Salesforce yesterday who was debating about staying at Salesforce or leaving. And I said, you know, the biggest difference between being in a big company like Salesforce is at a big tech company, you've got this sort of foundational layer of optimism in the company and everything that it's going to do. And even when the times are bad, they're not really bad because you're so convinced you're changing the world, that you're going to beat Oracle and SAP, everything's going to be fine. And in a startup, no matter how good you are, it's much more of an emotional roller coaster. And so I think for me, the big struggle in being authentic is trying to figure out how do I maintain my own emotional balance and when do I let my excitement through to the organization versus when do I temper my excitement and when do I let my concern through to the organization versus when do I temper my concern. And I've realized I need to put a little bit more of a filter on that than I initially thought, which I was like, hey, I'll be me and that's all good. That's good to be authentic, but then I think you have to think about like the ripple bullwhip effect on the rest of your team.
Yeah, especially in a leadership role, kind of like being a parent, right? Like everybody around you is just going to absorb the emotions.
Exactly.
And so if there's things to seriously be concerned about, then it's time to be concerned. If there's things that could be a concern, but it could also be mitigated, no reason to stress everyone out. Also with the positive, right? Sometimes what happens is people get excited and they share positive news that isn't confirmed yet and gets everyone excited. And then it's a letdown, right? You're not getting a pony for Christmas, but we talked about it. And then that happens. What do you think about when you hear the word persuasion?
I think really about the act of persuasion actually starts with taking in and processing information. I think when people think about persuasion, they immediately think, if I'm trying to persuade somebody, what do I need to do? What do I need to say? How do I need to say it? For me, it's how do you understand what your audience wants, what your audience cares about? What is it your audience believes in? You have to do that first before you can start talking. And so I feel like a huge part of persuasion is really putting yourself and your audience in their shoes and understanding their mindset and their mentality. And then the most effective way to craft how you want to persuade is based on that understanding. If you don't have that understanding, if you're Martin Luther King, you might still make it happen. But if you're a mere mortal in the art of persuading, then I think like your number one stopping point needs to be understanding your audience and what motivates them before you think about what you need to do.
I love it. What was it that you wanted to be when you were a kid? When you grew up?
When I was in middle school, I wanted to be a marine biologist. We spent a lot of vacations. I grew up in Atlanta. We spent a lot of vacations down in the Caribbean. I wanted to go be a marine biologist. And then as I approached adulthood, I actually studied international relations in undergrad. I doubled down on the pain and went back and got a master's degree in international relations along with my MBA, although I knew I would never go do that. But I thought coming out of undergrad, I actually wanted to go teach or work in the Foreign Service. And so I did an internship at the embassy in Greece my junior year, realized that the Foreign Service was probably not for me, stumbled into a job in business and consulting as sort of a way to explore options. And suddenly 20 years later, I've done nothing but software. Yeah. I think one of the things that especially young people today, they're so focused on advancing. I always say to them, like, you know, what's actually more important in your first few years in the workforce? It's not how fast you advance. It's, are you advancing in the right direction? I'll give you an example. At our company, we have people who come in to be SDRs. They think they want to go into sales because that's what they've been told they want to do. And there's one guy, I won't name his name, but he knows who he is. He's at Invoca, who started out as an SDR. He went into our customer success team, did some work there. And then he actually moved into product management. And it's been such a pleasure for me to see the great work that he's done and him learn about what he wanted to do. And he's gotten a double win because he's advanced very quickly, but he's zoned in on what is it that I want to do long term. And that's actually what's more important, I think, early in your career is confirming you're going to do for your life what you love rather than how fast can I get promoted two times in my first 3 or 4 years out of school? Because as I think you've done, Jason, if you find something that you love and you can be passionate about, like, you're going to be happy for the long term. And that's the really important thing to do earlier in your career.
And some people are fortunate. They grow up, they're like, I want to be a doctor. They go and be a doctor, and then they're a doctor and they love it and it's their calling and it was simple. And I've always been jealous of those people, at least for the longest time in my life, because that was definitely not me and my path. But I agree. I've done that as a leader in organizations where I don't see the role. It's just helping someone do well at the job they're at. But what do they want to do and where should they be, and putting square pegs in square holes? And it always makes me excited, those kind of stories, when I've done that internally as well, which is, you should not be in sales. You should be over here. They might resist it because they think that's failure, because they're supposed to move up, not over. They get into a different role and they're like, oh my gosh, this is it. Like, we can usually see it from the outside and be like, you should not be in sales. I don't know who hired you, but you should not be here. You're great. You fit our culture. You have wonderful attributes that fit what we want over here. And that's what life's about. And I don't know if you remember this from earliest conversations, but my bachelor's degree is in marine biology from UC Santa Cruz. And I tagged sharks for years. So yeah, I also wanted to be in marine biology and do stuff. I did that and then didn't use that, like you and your international affairs. So yeah. For you, which one, the journey or the destination?
Oh, journey without a doubt. I was saying to somebody yesterday, like, when I came to Invoca, for me, the thing that motivates me in my jobs is learning. And so in every job I look at, I'm like, am I learning something? Am I growing? Am I challenging myself? My wife is super frustrated with me because I've told her again and again and again, like, I don't think I'm ever going to retire. What I'd love to do at the end of my career is I'd love to go back to where I thought I was going to begin, which is to teach. And I love the idea of being around younger people in the younger generation. But like, the moment I stop learning and expanding and challenging myself is the moment mentally I'll just be done. And so the journey and sort of constantly learning and evolving is definitely what's most important to me. Although the destination is nice too. Can't complain about that.
There you go. Love it. And then last question, what is your definition of success? Either personally, professionally?
Yeah, I think professionally it comes back to the last point, which is, am I learning and growing and doing the things that I want to do? I think on a personal level, I've got a family with 3 boys and a lovely wife, and I kind of move back and forth between my work life and my personal life relatively easily. And so I feel like I can get the level of personal fulfillment out of being a dad, as well as spend and invest time with my kids and make sure they're getting what they want. And so I find that I've been able to balance those two things really well. I haven't had as many struggles with sort of managing those two as a lot of people have. But I think ultimately a lot of it is, I say at times, like, we forget that for many, many people at work, like, work is now kind of the equivalent of sports when you're growing up, whether you're like a gymnast or you play tennis or you did ice skating or football or basketball. Like, work is the collective thing that we do together that brings us a sense of identity out of our family. And I think people, they want to be successful, but they also want to do good in the world, and they want to feel like they're improving society for a better. And kind of work is oftentimes now the collective vehicle to do that. So I think for me too, it's trying to think about, what can we as a team, what can we as a company do, not only to be successful in our marketplace, but also what can we do to help improve the world around us? So I think that's a big part of it for me too.
Awesome. I appreciate that so much, and the sentiment and that focus. And Greg, I appreciate you coming on the show, and at least for the Authentic Persuasion show, setting a new record, might be an all-time record for conversations on here. So thank you for all of that.
Oh, my pleasure. And whenever you figure out the secret sauce answer to the optimal sales and marketing mix, just let me know. I would definitely love to come have it about it out as well.
We'll do it again. So for everyone listening and or watching this, the main site for your company, Invoca, it's Invoca. So Invoca.com. Also, you have the marketing. So there's Invoca for marketing as well. Yeah. Invoca.com/solutions/marketing. And I'll put all these in the show notes. And then there's one for sales now as you're developing that, which is Invoca.com/solutions/sales. And then I know that you're very active on LinkedIn. That's how we actually connected. I'd sent you a message and it started this conversation in our relationship, which is amazing. So anybody wants to find you, you're on LinkedIn. And again, Greg, thank you so much for coming and for sharing everything. And yeah, we'll definitely have to do this again.
Yeah, great. I appreciate you having me on the show, Jason. Always great to talk. Appreciate the conversation.
Yeah. All right. Take care and have a great day.
You too.
Thanks for tuning into the Authentic Persuasion Show. If you found value in this episode, please do two things. Subscribe so you can get each new episode, and share this episode with anyone else you know in sales. Together, we can help shift the way sales is done. And if you want to find out more information about how to transform your sales career, or you want help with shifting your sales team from order takers to quota breakers, go to jasoncutter.com. Don't forget that everything in life is sales, and I will catch you on the next episode of the Authentic Persuasion Show.